Welcome on to a Thursday edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I was sitting around today and realized that there's really only about a month and a half until the season starts, actually less than that. And so we have 30 team previews to get to, and it's time to get cracking on those. So to bring in his inexplicably beloved Clippers and preview them is my good friend and all-you-can-eat buffet partner, Fred Katz. Fred, what's up?
You know what? I'm going to defend my Clippers fandom, and I'm going to say that being from Los Angeles and being a Clippers fan in some ways is even more crazy than just being a Clippers fan when you're not from Los Angeles.
Well, so what's the story? You grew up on the East Coast. What could possibly have made you love the Clippers?
So I started playing with them in, what was it, NBA Live? Kobe Bryant NBA Courtside. I always mix up those games. On N64 in, like, 98. And because Eric Pietkowski was amazing. And eventually, after having a couple years of my dad turning me against the Knicks because he did business that involved James Dolan and was not his biggest fan, and that was right around when Dolan was becoming a fan of the Knicks, or was becoming owner of the Knicks, I should say, I just became a Clippers fan. And so I attribute my Clippers, the fact that I'm a Clippers fan, mostly to, not to Eric Pietkowski, but the digital version of the Polish rifle.
Who I'm sure is much more effective than the actual version.
Oh, he was amazing in that game. He was incredible.
And probably had like a better hairline as well.
Well, he was killer in that game, because those games like that, it's like the overall rating doesn't matter. If you can shoot, then you're just amazing. And if you can like get their release point down, especially in that day and age when it was like, you know, four different shooting forms for like aggregated around every single player in the league, like it was. And you could just, yeah, you could get one guy shooting form down, and I killed it with Pietkowski. It was great. Those were the good old days.
All right. Well, it's an exciting time to be a Clippers fan, I guess, because they actually had a really good off season. But now it's time to talk about what they're going to be like for this year. And so basically, we're going to go through a pretty consistent format with all these season previews. And for me, when I start thinking about how good a team's going to be this year, I think the place to start, obviously, is how good were they last year. So how good was this team last year?
Well, I think for the Clippers, that's a more complicated question than with other teams, because they were so good at the top. That starting lineup was so good. The top six, when Crawford was going well, was great. And the thing was, in the playoffs and really the second half of the season, and especially in the postseason, Crawford wasn't going. And they just had, except for when, you know, Austin Rivers had about three good performances off the bench in the postseason when he scored really well, and those were
entirely
great.
Entirely replicable performances.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure we'll see those like every two or three games in the regular season this year, right? But you know, aside from those games, I mean, the Clippers got no help from the bench. So it was one of the stranger teams in the league, and it wasn't that it was – I mean, there are shallow teams. There are always going to be teams that are, you know, Oklahoma City this year, you could argue, is great starting lineup, and they're going to be shallow off the bench. But this team, the divide was just so unbelievably obvious. Starting lineup, great. Put any bench player in, and it doesn't work. And I think this year's team is going to be a lot different. I mean, the bench is just so obviously better, which is going to make a huge difference, I think, from last year's team to this year's team. I mean, on top of that, I think a lot of their players, you know, the Blake specifically, coasts through the regular season, turns it up in the postseason. To be honest, I'm not quite sure how good last year's team was. I think they were somewhere between good and very good. They had a lot of peaks and valleys, and they were bad at the beginning of the year, got good, fell back down again, and they were really good those last, you know, 13 games of the regular season. And then in the postseason, right up until they had that 3-1 lead on Houston, I think this year it'll be a different sort of deal, though. They're going to be more rested heading into the postseason, considering just there's no way the bench is going to be as poor as it was last year.
Yeah, you can make the argument that this was either the second or third best team in basketball last year. When you look at their overall resume during the regular season, their point differential, how effective their starting lineup was, as you said, I mean, I think that was the best five-man unit in the NBA, that starting lineup that played over a certain number of minutes. And then, you know, that they had the number one offense, as they seemed to pretty much be right up there whenever you have Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and some decent shooting around them. You know, you've got a great offensive team. But on the other hand, you know, they barely beat the Spurs in a series where they had home court advantage, and then they lost to the Rockets, even though I think most people would say they were probably a better team than the Rockets, and they lost in the second round. They still haven't made the conference finals. But, I mean, I think this is a team with a very good foundation. The question, though, is I think there's going to be a lot more competition this year if the other teams can stay healthy, and they needed to upgrade, but they kind of did.
Yeah, I mean, the West is going to be so strong, really. I mean, you know, we talk about that top four. Golden State is pretty much returning the same crew. You know, Houston and Oklahoma City will presumably be healthier. Obviously, San Antonio is going to be really good, although I know you're probably on the same page as me about, you know, questions about maybe some of their veterans, specifically Tony Parker, if they're going to be as good as they were in the past. But that being said, yeah, you know, I think New Orleans will be better. With just because Anthony Davis is going to be better, and I like Alvin Gentry a lot. I think Utah is going to be really competitive. Yeah, the West is going to be really tough. But like I said, even if the Clippers bench is just average this year, that's going to make a huge difference because Blake Griffin is not going to have to be top 10 in the league in minutes. Chris Paul is not going to have to play 82 games. They're not going to have to exhaust themselves in the postseason over and over again. I mean, what Blake Griffin had to do last year in the postseason – I thought was really underrated, and maybe justifiably so, because yep. They didn't make it past the second round. But
through game five of that, through game four of that series against the Rockets, I think he was clearly the MVP of the playoffs.
Yeah, and not so much just the quality of what he was doing, but just his usage. And I'm not even talking about usage rate. I'm just talking about how hard he had to go on every single possession. And how important he was to every single thing that they were doing. It's really, really hard for a player to keep up like that. And it's really, really hard mentally on a guy when he has to go out there in every single possession, just play a perfect possession. And when he can take off time and he can hand off not necessarily minutes or possessions, but responsibilities per possession to other guys because other guys are just more competent, that's a huge load off your back and can lead guys playing way better. I really think part of the collapse, I mean, people say they got tense, that they got tight or that they choked or whatever it is, and even the Clippers admitted to getting tight. Doc used that term like 12 times. And I do think that was certainly a part of it. But I also think there's a nuanced answer, which is that they tired themselves out. There were four or five guys on that team who were playing good basketball. By the last few games, Matt Barnes wasn't hitting shots either and became a serious liability on the floor because guys weren't even guarding him when Griffin or Paul would get into the lane. And I think we're not going to see that this year, which is going to make a ginormous difference.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the fact that Blake couldn't condition at all for that period when he had his elbow injury – and he basically just like couldn't even get it sweaty or anything when he was recovering from the infection. You know, I think that's it's hard to just go from three straight weeks off and then, you know, he came back, but to get into absolute peak condition like he needed to be. And then, you know, when he was basically playing like a point power forward when Paul was out at the beginning of that Rockets series, yeah, I think it makes plenty of sense that he ran out of gas. You touched on this a little bit, but how do you see these new additions that they have fitting in? And so, you know, we're talking about Prigioni at the point guard, Lance Stephenson at the two, Paul Pierce and Wes Johnson at the three, although I like Wes better as a four. And then, of course, Josh Smith and even Cole Aldrich at the big positions.
Don't forget about my guy Chuck Hayes, too.
Is he actually your guy? Like, do you have some relationship with him, or are you just...
I have absolutely no relationship.
Yeah, what is like the closest that you can be to someone to start saying my guy? Like, do you have to have a personal relationship? Are you like overstepping your bounds there by using that phrase?
I feel like you can say my guy if you have a very good relationship with them or if you have absolutely no relationship. and I'm more on the latter one on that. But was excited about that signing because I do like Chuck Hayes.
Well, let's talk about Josh Smith first. To me, I think he is one of the biggest signings. He gives them the best front court reserve that they've had. Now, you always wonder a little bit about the bench because the guys that they bring in every year always seem to somehow flop and never live up to their potential. But, you know, I mean, Spencer Hawes last year was supposed to be the solution. But to me, Smith is the better option because he can play with DeAndre, which Hawes couldn't really do last year. And, you know, he also can play with Blake against reserve units. He would just be just fine as a center against reserve units. And he also gets out in transition. He'll help their transition game. I think he's a great fit.
Yeah, I was really excited about that signing. I think it's and let's not forget that, Josh Smith, people like to brag on Josh Smith a lot. And I think one of the problems that I don't mean you and me. I kind of mean just the NBA community, which encompasses, basketball fans as a whole. We have trouble separating a player's abilities from his actual contract. And then when the contract that he's on goes away, we still have those same thoughts on him. You know, Joe Johnson, we always talk about how Joe Johnson is crazy overpaid. And he is. He's the second highest paid player in the league this year. And he's obviously far from the second best player. But Joe Johnson is a quality player for a price. And if you ask any general manager, do you like this player? Do you not like this player? They're always going to ask you back, well, what am I paying that guy? Josh Smith wasn't a good get for $13.5 million a year like he was getting on the Pistons. I'll happily take Josh Smith if it means that I'm getting him for the minimum like the Clippers are. I was really excited about that. And let's not forget that he's also one of the best passing fours out there. I think the Clippers now have one of the best
over that same role as Blake Griffin, with bench units as well. Do you feel okay about where they are now with backups for Chris Paul? That strikes me as one of their two biggest weaknesses. The other one being just the overall defense when you're talking about the elite teams. But, is this team still going to struggle without Paul on the floor?
I think they think that Lance Stephenson is going to be the backup point guard, right? I mean, that's got to be what it is. And I don't know. I mean, I would be lying. I don't think anybody knows what Lance Stephenson is showing up this year, right? Like, I have no clue. It's going to be one of them, but who knows, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would be almost impossible for him to be worse than he was last year, and this is obviously going to put him in a much better chance to succeed. I think he's been somewhat humbled by his experience last year in Charlotte, so that's all good. I mean, I think, but with Rivers and Prigioni, you still wonder. I mean, Prigioni is an underrated guy, but I think he's going to be 38 this year, so I think especially in the playoffs still, which is really what this team is building toward, they may still struggle with Paul off the floor, even if they are going to be using Lance, maybe not as the point guard, but as sort of the guy, the main ball handler, like it was used in Indiana with the second unit.
Yeah, I mean, I think their strategy in replacing Chris Paul is going to kind of be replacing him on the aggregate. You have a lot of guys who like to handle the ball, who maybe aren't necessarily point guards, aren't point guard denominations, but they're guys who can play the one. Rivers is more of a combo guard. Prigioni is, like you said, 38 and is – even when Paul doesn't play, you're not going to play him 36 minutes in his place. Stephenson is a two or a three, but he can run the offense. Even Jamal Crawford is a two, but he can, take over your ball handling, responsibilities in short stretches. And I think that's probably how they're going to replace him. Resigning Austin Rivers kind of handicapped them in that sense that they're not going to be able to get, if they're getting Prigioni, they're not going to be able to bring back a real point guard to back him up because they gave $3.1 million to Rivers. But that was an inevitability. So, what are you going to do?
I also worry a little bit that, and this has been talked about with Oklahoma City, but I think it could be an issue with this team too. You got a lot of guns on this team, right? Like Crawford, Lance Stephenson, Smith, Austin Rivers. Those are three guys who are four guys who probably at various points in their career have shot way more than they really should. And now if they can scale back their role to really let Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan and even Paul Pierce still be the main guys, J.J. Redick, that's great. But if those guys shoot too much, that could actually drag their efficiency down slightly, especially in the regular season when I think we'll see a lot more of those guys playing with the starters as they try and keep the minutes down.
Yeah, and it's not so much that those guys shoot a lot. I mean, you're right. I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that's why we've heard a lot of Jamal Crawford rumors, because it's like, how the heck is Jamal Crawford going to fit on the court on both sides of the ball with Lance Stephenson and Austin Rivers? I'm not really sure how that's going to work. But But it's not so much that those guys take a lot of shots. It's that they need the ball to take those shots, too. You don't see Jamal. I mean, Jamal's a good, very good catch-and-shoot guy, actually, if you throw him at the three-point line. But he's not going to be cutting. Austin Rivers, actually, I think, got a little bit better towards the end of the year at that last year. But he's not an off-ball player. Lance Stephenson is not an off-ball player. They don't have complementary traits. And you can take those guys and say they're good in certain roles, but they're all good in similar roles. I could see that not meshing. But those guys are good enough that you have the ability to make some sort of swap in the middle of the season if things aren't working out, I think.
Yeah, nonetheless, while I do have some concerns about the fit, I think they have more quality players on the team. I think that resting Blake more, DeAndre could use some more rest too. I mean, he plays a ton of minutes for a center. So resting those three guys throughout the course of the season will help. Although, on the other hand, they are going to have some huge competition for seeding in the West. And I think at least getting one of those top two seeds, you can get home court in both of the rounds, is going to be a priority. But, you know, we'll kind of see where they fall. And, you know, I mean, if Blake or Chris gets injured for any amount of time, that probably won't be realistic to get one of those top two seeds anyway. So let's move on then, because kind of the second component that I think about in projecting a team, aside from how good they were last year, is who's likely to be better and who's likely to be worse. So who are the best guys here among the main players that you expect to be improved this year?
I am honestly really excited to see how DeAndre Jordan does. And it's not just because he had this weird, you know, emotional off season.
How can he get better, though? That's my question. Like, what skills can he actually improve at this point?
I think he can get a lot better defensively. I'm a Clippers fan, but I'm not of the camp that DeAndre Jordan is one of the three best defensive players in the league. I think he's a good defender for sure. He's probably a very good
defender. And at times he can get to that level, right?
Absolutely. No. I mean, you see him in there are individual games. I still think the best basketball he's ever played over a stretch of his career was the Warriors series in the first round in 2014.
Yeah, yeah, he killed all of those guys, especially, and on the offensive glass as well, he was great in that series.
Unbelievable in every aspect. Now, granted, Bogut didn't play in that series, so things were a lot easier on him. But fundamentally, he was great. His pick-and-roll defense was phenomenal. He helped promptly. I mean, he plays great defense for the first 5 minutes of a game, I start to get worried because great defense will lead to two or three blocks early, and then all of a sudden he gets antsy. He starts getting block happy, he gets jumpy, he chases blocks, he starts helping late, he gets caught out of position. And, you know, you can look at he's a very good player. I think he's actually better off. He has more offensive value on this team than he does defensive value. You can make that argument legitimately with the way he pulls in gravity on the pick and roll and the way he finishes in his offensive rebounding. But I think offensively he is what he is, and I think the free throws are going to stay as is. But if he can polish his defense with his athletic ability and his just overall defensive ability, I think he can become one of the best defensive players in the league. And we've seen a steady progression. Like, he was better in March last year than he was in December last year. And he was better in December last year than he was when the Clippers went into the playoffs last year, save that Warriors series. So I think we've seen steady progression from him under Doc. I think Doc is a phenomenal coach for him. I think it's one of the best things under Doc's tenure is DeAndre's consistent improvement. And he's still young, 27 years old. I would not be surprised to see him make another leap this year. I really wouldn't.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, I think he's kind of all or nothing. He'll go for some crazy blocks, as you noted. Other times, he just won't jump at all. You know, I think, and that like a more consistent, maybe conservative approach where he's just kind of going for more of a verticality approach, but also just making sure that he's there for every shot might help him. How about Blake? Is he going to be better this year or worse? You know, I worried about him last year that he really was missing the explosiveness. I mean, he doesn't have those nuclear highlight dunks nearly as often as he did earlier in his career. Part of that, he claims, is because he just, you know, it's just hard to dunk and it takes a toll on your body. And he was more aggressive during the playoffs, but he still doesn't quite get up the same way that he did. He's a guy who's pretty reliant on his athleticism, but he can also add to his skills, including his jumper. So do you think that, is this the year that the declining athleticism starts to make him go down, or can he go up another level still?
Yeah, I have a theory about Blake, and I'm pretty confident in it. I think Blake's career now is basically going to be what we saw last year. Now, I don't think that means he's not going to be He's not going to get better. He's not going to get smarter. He's not going to improve his skills. But in terms of people questioning why is Blake not dunking on people, that kind of stuff, I think those days are going to stick around. And then Blake is really smart. Like, he's a really, really smart guy. He's like LeBron with the way that he paces himself now. And I think it took LeBron until he was 30 to realize, I got to cool this. I got to take vacations in the middle of the year. And I can't go all out all the time. And I think Blake realized that younger. I think he was the benefit of kind of a generation that had that, you know, given to him when he was at a younger age. But Blake was very particular and intentional with the way that he coasted through last season. And he went all out in the postseason. And I think we're just going to see – I don't think we're going to see him average a ton of rebounds, especially with the way DeAndre steals them. I don't think we're going to see him dunking on guys in the regular season. It's not his priority. And I had a problem with that last year until I saw him in the postseason just go for, like, what he averaged, 26, 13, and 6 or something in the postseason. And he wrote that article for Players Tribune about how when he was a rookie, he couldn't feel his legs when he woke up in February. I was like, you know what? I get it. I understand this. He's going through this more than me, and I kind of understand the logic. And if he thinks that's what he needs to do, then fine. You know, I think we're going to start seeing that from a lot of guys.
I was worried about him last year because you didn't see that, and you started to wonder. And if he hadn't turned it on in the playoffs like he did, I would feel a lot worse about him. How about Chris Paul? I mean, I've sort of been predicting now. I mean, he turned 30 this year, that he is going to have age-related decline, and he did. I mean, he almost never gets to the basket anymore, but his mid-range jumper is so money, and he's obviously, he got up to about 40% on threes last year, too. What about him? Can he stave off the age-related decline for another year?
Yeah, Chris Paul's really interesting, right? Because his ability to maintain his dominance is all about his improved shooting, right? I mean, he's always been a good shooter, but his numbers and his effectiveness has stayed the same over the years. Like, last year, I think, was the highest or second highest true shooting percentage of his career. And you're right, he almost never gets to the basket. It was the lowest free throw rate of his career. He's not getting to the line. He's not getting to the rim. But he is insane from mid-range. He's one of the only guys in the league who, when he takes a contested mid-range jumper, you're just like, okay, that's not a bad possession. And his three-point shooting jumped up. I mean, if he can shoot at the level he did last year, okay. I don't know if that's sustainable for years to come. I mean, I think that's just an unbelievable shooting year, right? I mean, is that –
Yeah. I mean, 40% on threes I think is a little bit more than we should necessarily expect from him. I would expect to see that regress to kind of the 37-38% range. But – you know, and also he always seems to struggle with, like, these hamstring injuries in the playoffs as well. So, I mean, I think that kind of risk is there as well. I mean, I thought he was good. Last year was going to be the year that we weren't talking about him as legitimately a possible top five player. And he proved me wrong there. Do you think that this year there will still be a plausible argument that he's a top five player when we're done with this year?
Well, I've been on the same train as you with Chris Paul, kind of predicting his downfall. One thing I didn't like about last year was that he played 82 games, and he was super proud of that. He was talking everyone's ear off about how he played 82 games for the first time in his career, and he's kind of had injury problems, especially over the last 5 or 6 years or so. And he played 82, and I think part of the reason was the Clippers didn't have any depth, and he kind of was forced to play 82, plus he wanted to. This year, like, I think they should just rest him on the second half of back-to-backs. I just wouldn't be against
it. Well, all right, so if you do that, you're basically giving up any chance at a top two seed. That's worth it to you?
Yes, because Chris Paul has literally been hampered by some sort of injury every season he's been with the Clippers. And if you can guarantee – he was hurt last year too, and he played 82 in the regular season. So they got their number three seed, and which under the new rules that were just changed would have been a two seed because the division for Houston wouldn't have mattered. But they got the three seed, and Paul was banged up in the playoffs, and you can argue that that hurt them to some degree. What degree, I don't know, but he hurt them to some degree because hurt Chris Paul is not as good as healthy Chris Paul. And I would much rather ensure healthy Chris Paul and a 3 or 4 seed than potentially injured Chris Paul in the postseason for the fifth year in a row and a 2 or a 1.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a reasonable argument there, and you know, this is a team that I don't think that home court matters that much for them. You know, they don't have some unbelievable home court advantage. You know, I mean, they lost to Memphis when they had home court, although that was partially because of Blake Griffin's injury. You know, they lost to you could argue that if they had home court against Houston last year, they might have won that series. And I think home court was pretty important in the San Antonio series. So I don't know. It's tough. I mean, you do want to always have your guys healthy. I mean, to me, my approach might be, you know, if he really is running out of gas and your sports science guys say, hey, you know, he needs a break, then yeah, rest him, you know, be proactive, but, you know, not necessarily quite to those extreme levels. So you follow the team very closely, obviously. For the more casual fan, who's better than you think on this team? Who's worse than you think on this team?
I think J.J. Redick is better than the casual fan realizes. He's just so important to the offense with his movement off the ball, the sets that the Clippers are able to run. I mean, if you really pay attention to the offensive packages that the Clippers use when Redick plays and when Redick doesn't play, it is incredible. I mean, they're not running like at least a third of their stuff when Redick isn't on the floor, because nobody else can run that stuff. And it's not just guys on the team. It's a lot of guys around the league. I mean, how many guys can you plug into Redick's role? Like offensively, Danny Green, Kyle Korver, maybe a few others. And that's like about it with the way that he runs off screens. He's one of the best conditioned players in the league, how he doesn't get tired. He plays minutes. He's a capable team defender. He's actually a very good James Harden defender because he's smart and doesn't get goaded on a lot of those Harden bait fouls. I mean, I know you're a Redick fan, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he's critical in both his ability to run off screens, as you said, but also just because they run so much pick and roll, and when they throw the ball to Blake Griffin at the free throw line on that short roll, and you have to help off of somewhere for that, right? You can't help with the center because DeAndre Jordan's lurking on the baseline for an alley-oop dunk. So that help is going to have to come from the opposite wing. Well, if you do that and Redick is on the opposite wing, then it's a three for him. You know, I mean, when that was Matt Barnes, it was much more difficult. And, you know, I mean, if it's going to be Lance Stephenson this year, it's going to be much more difficult. They're going to be helping off of him. So, yeah, he plays a really critical role as really their only money shooter, and especially on a team where you have two traditional bigs.
How about on the other side of the coin, you have to look at Jamal Crawford as someone who might be a little overrated compared to what they project to do this year.
I'm not particularly encouraged by what, you know, we might see from Crawford this year, especially like we were talking about earlier with those bench players who are not the best compliments for his game.
You know, when he signed, I actually thought it was a bad contract by them. I mean, this is back in those days when, like, you know, a $4 or $5 million contract was actually like a pretty big one as when the salary cap was stagnant. But I was like, yeah, this guy's like 31 when he's signing, like, you know, but he actually staved off age-related decline very well, but finally began to struggle last year. And then I think that cap injury didn't help him much either. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think DeAndre would probably be the other guy who, well, I think he was worth the contract that he got, you know, as we talked about, not really a, you know, top three level defender in the league, despite the fact that he does some pretty flashy things defensively. All right. What do you see any kind of big questions here for this team as, like, you know, in the rotation? What are the questions, like, where they have too many guys, where one guy might play at the expense of someone else who's, you know, a bigger name, any of those issues? What is Doc Rivers going to have to sort out this year?
I mean, the personalities are going to be interesting. I don't think there is any debate about that one. I mean, I don't know if they had the strongest locker room in the league last year. You know, I can't wait to see how much Chris Paul is going to be yelling at Lance Stephenson. But there are so many personalities in that locker room now. You know, for all the criticism thrown Josh Smith's way, he's never really been known as a bad guy. I don't really hear anything bad about his personality. But Josh Smith wants his shots, and Lance Stephenson wants his shots, and Jamal Crawford's a wonderful guy, but he wants his shots. And when everybody wants their shots and they're not getting them, things tend to go down, even if you have, you know, seven versions of Mother Teresa coming off the bench. And it's things can become problems. I think this is going to be – what's interesting is that normally when you have a situation like this, you say that the GM put a lot of trust in the coach and the ability to make – in the ability to manage personalities. But in this sort of sense, kind of Doc had confidence in his own abilities, right? I mean, it's kind of a weird way to think about it, but it's almost like Doc, the GM, is saying to himself, all right, I'm going to be able to do this.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think the Crawford, Rivers, Stevenson, all three of those are guys who are sort of prototypical gunner off the bench types. I don't think there's going to be room for all those guys to play the minutes that they might expect. They are talking about starting Wes Johnson at small forward, which is ridiculous. I mean, he's barely an NBA player as like a backup small ball power forward. So starting him at the three would be pretty preposterous, even though they want to keep Pierce's minutes down. You might see Lance playing a lot of 3-2. That could maybe alleviate some of that backcourt minutes crunch. Other than that, I don't see like a ton of issues. You agree that the projected starters, if it's Pierce at the three, that should be their crunch time lineup almost invariably. That's my opinion.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think you mix and match depending. The beauty of their offseason was that they got so many guys who are versatile. You know, Josh Smith allows them to play small ball. Basically, everyone they signed can play multiple positions. Lance can play the two and the three, and he can run the offense while he's doing it, so you don't necessarily need a conventional point guard out there if things are going the right way. You know, Josh Smith can play multiple forward positions. Even Wes Johnson, who I probably agree with you on his abilities, he can play the three and the four. So you can mix and match. But, yeah, I mean, if we're speaking in generalities, yeah, Pierce at the three in crunch time for sure.
Yeah, I can't see very many situations. I mean, maybe you'll see him go with Smith instead of DeAndre, although Smith isn't some amazing free throw shooter either, just because of that. I've never agreed with taking a guy out for that reason, but we may see him do that nonetheless. But I can't imagine any situation where you'd want to be playing Lance over Paul Pierce or Redick, not to mention Crawford, over either of those two guys in the clutch, unless there's some sort of an injury concern, in my personal opinion.
Well, Nate, can I cut you off for a sec?
What?
Can I cut you off for a sec?
Absolutely.
All right. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Jamal Crawford at 34 falling off, or Chris Paul at 30 falling off, and we're just kind of writing in Paul Pierce is like, yeah, he'll be the same guy. I mean, can we say that 38-year-old Paul Pierce with confidence is going to be the exact same player? I mean, he's done a very nice job, you know, making himself into a really good role player. But can we say with confidence, Paul Pierce, there's no way he's fallen off? Because I can't say that for certain.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, a lot of times that's due to kind of some age-related injuries. But, yeah, now you make a good point that he could just kind of be done-ish and not really be the same force that he was. Although I think just his reputation, and which he's cemented – last year with Washington, with all the clutch shots, might be worth something simply on its own, especially in a playoff series of teams feeling like they have to guard him. So the strengths we talked about, I mean, it's basically just the entire offense is a great offense, you know, and Blake's playmaking, all that stuff. We've hit that, but what do you see as the key weaknesses on this team that could be their downfall, especially when we're talking in the rarefied air of these Western Conference contenders?
I'm still not sold on their defense. I mean, they were 15th in points allowed per possession last year. Pretty mediocre. Got better in the second half of the season once DeAndre started to get better. They didn't necessarily address their inability to guard larger wings. And, you know, people talk about who's going to guard LeBron or who's going to guard Durant. I don't really care about that. Because, you know what, most teams don't have anybody who can guard people of that ability.
Yeah. Well, two teams you're going to have to probably beat to win the championship do.
Yes, but the way that you guard those guys is by guarding their teams, is not necessarily just them. The problem with the Clippers is they didn't have a guy last year who could guard Gerald Green. I mean, that was the bigger issue. You know, LeBron and Durant are going to get their numbers. There are lots of teams that don't have that. But I mean, it's really a problem when guys like Gerald Green are constantly going off against you. And I don't necessarily know if they have that guy yet. I mean, Lance, you know, is a question mark and can be a good defender when he really goes at it, but he's still not necessarily a big guy. He's 6'4" with a nice wingspan who can at times struggle against, you know, 6'8", 6'9", small forwards for sure, because if a guy's got a good stroke, he can still shoot over him, even if Nance is going to muscle him up. And Paul Pierce is not the defender he was a few years ago, I don't think. So I still think that could be a problem for this team. I guess they think that Wes Johnson is going to be that guy. I think there's a decent chance he'll be disappointed, you know, if he's not. But I'm not confident that they address that need over the offseason.
Yeah, I agree with you. And just generally, I don't think there is a ton of reason to think that they're going to be much better defensively than they were last year. You might point to DeAndre continuing to improve, Blake continuing to improve, and that front court defense is important, but I think, you know, Chris Paul continuing to be a good defensive point guard becomes less likely as we go through each year, and Redick also is getting into his 30s, so that may not be, you know, that great of a defensive backcourt anymore. And Pierce, you know, I think probably the more likely fall off for him might even be defensively at his age. You know, I don't think he can really realistically guard someone like Kevin Durant at this point. And then, you know, in your starting lineup, that he has to do that if he's going to start, because it's not going to be J.J. Redick. So, yeah, I mean, that's the reason why I see them as just slightly below some of the top contenders, because I just don't think they have the ability to really have a great defense and to put up great defensive performances.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's legitimate. But you know, this is also, and I'm going to, even though I just made the exact opposite point, I'm going to make this point too. Clippers were in devil's advocate. Clippers were a top 10 defense 2 years ago, with the same core.
Yeah. Wasn't that kind of overrated though, in some respects, like their defensive improvement that year? I felt like it was.
Yeah. Well, I felt like a lot of their struggles on defense last year were due to the fact that Blake was just awful during the regular season. And he was better during the playoffs. He was way better defensively 2 years ago. He was never a great defender, but he steps himself up. He stepped himself up 2 years ago. He had the best defensive year of his career and was...
What was the difference between last year and 2 years ago?
His recovery on pick and rolls last year was just horrible.
Yeah, that's especially because they try and trap out high and he's got to get back into the play. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, and his recovery, and that's always been his biggest issue on defense. But 2 years ago, he got a lot better at it, and he was okay. And I would say that he was not a great defender. He was an average defender 2 years ago. But when you're an average defender and you're a number three in MVP voting caliber offensive player, then you're a pretty darn good player. Last year, his defense just fell off a cliff. And I think it was probably an effort thing. I don't know if it was totally an effort thing, but I think effort had a lot to do with it, because we saw it go up with an uptick in effort in the postseason to a lot better, because he's a smart guy and he knows how to play defense, but he just doesn't execute it a lot of the time. And, you know, we'll see what kind of defense we get from Blake this year, whether it's 2 years ago or last year. But he was very bad defensively, I thought, last year, and I thought that was a big reason. They got killed on the pick and roll often, and I think Blake has to take a decent amount of the blame for that.
Yeah, and maybe you can say, too, if he and DeAndre can play fewer minutes, that could really help their defense during the regular season when they are in there. We may have touched on some of this already, at least for me, you know, but the key questions that are going to determine, you know, a yay or nay answer on this question is going to determine how good this team is. For me, the biggest part of it is, you know, how much are the three main guys going to improve or decline? I mean, even with, and especially Paul, in particular, for me, that's a big question. But what are they for you on that's going to determine the success or failure of this team ultimately?
Ooh, that's such a broad question, Nate.
Yeah, I mean, well, as you know, as you look at it, I don't know if you don't have.
Yeah,
anything,
no, I mean, I guess I, you know, I'll stick to what we've just been talking about. It's probably the defense. The offense is.
Yeah.
The offense is incredible. I mean, the offense might be the best. They've been the number one ranked offense in the league 2 years in a row. And the offense might be better this year than it was last year. Their offense is fantastic. And I don't think that's going to change one bit. defensively, like we said, I mean, that's the difference. You got the best offense in the league and you're not the best team in the league, then look on the other end of the floor to see why not. yeah, there's the defensive inconsistency. DeAndre is very good, but he can't make up for everything. Even if he gets a lot better, there's still problems. Like you said, you know, one-on-one defense on the perimeter with the bigger wings. And yeah, I agree with you that at some point, you know, age tends to show on the defensive end before the offensive end. And at some point, we're going to start to see that with Chris Paul. He was so good defensively last year. I mean, he was really, really a bull defensively last year. But, you know, we're going to see him fall off at some point. And even the guys they got on the bench are not – they're fine defensively, but it's not like they got any lockdown defenders unless Lance, you know, really reaches his potential, which is possible, but I'm not betting on it. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't – I think they'll be an above-average defense. I don't think – you know, you look at top 10 defenses, the only two teams to win a championship and not be a top 10 defense since the merger are the 95 Rockets and the 01 Lakers. And those were both repeat champions who notoriously cruised through the regular season and turned it on during the playoffs. So I don't know if they're a top 10 defense.
All right. Yeah, I think that's really one of the key questions for me, too. Now, let's talk about just where you see them finishing. What is the best case scenario for this team? How many wins, where do they finish in the playoffs, and what has to happen for them to reach that ceiling?
Best case scenario, I mean, I think they could plausibly get the one seed and be a 60-plus win team.
I mean, I think they could win the championship. Like, that's totally possible for this team, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are five teams that can win the championship, and it's the five obvious ones. It's in no order: Clippers, Spurs, Warriors, Cavs, and Thunder.
Not putting Houston in that mix?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Houston. Yeah. Okay. It's still September. Sure, Houston. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Houston's very good. And Houston had, you know, Dwight wasn't healthy and Mota Yunus wasn't healthy. And yeah. And they made the conference finals.
And they got Lawson now. So, you know, I mean, you could see how that team has some upside. Yeah, I mean, I could see this team winning. You know, I wouldn't say more than like 62 games just because I see – you know, that they're going to try and limit people's minutes. And, but yeah, I mean, that's totally within the realm of possibility, I feel like, for this team. But what has to happen for them to fulfill that potential?
Well, they need Indiana Lance for sure. I mean, this team needs Indiana Lance on both sides of the floor. They need him competently running a second unit. Indiana Lance was a great passer. Was a good enough shooter that he wasn't putting up one of the historically worst three-point shooting seasons in the history of the NBA. I think Lance had the worst three-point percentage of anyone ever to take more than 100 threes in a season last year. something like that. It was darn close to it.
Yeah, it was like 18. He shot like 18%. And he was like – or no, I think he might have shot like 18%, like all jump shots, which is – yeah, that's horrible. But he shot 34% on threes the preceding year. So, you know, it's not inconceivable that he could get back to that.
Right. And 34% on threes in like an offense which was not getting you incredible open shots with amazing spacing. Like, the Pacers always had spacing issues.
Yeah.
And he was 34% on not an insanely high volume of threes, but I forget the numbers, but it was a respectable amount of threes. Yeah, I mean, if they get Lance, who can run an offense behind Chris Paul, because one of their flaws is that they don't really have a high minutes, you know, backup point guard who you would want if Chris Paul goes down for a stretch, or if, you know, you need important third quarter minutes and you need to give Chris Paul a rest in a game seven. Who are you going to want running your offense right now? Honestly, the answer to that is just have the point guard dribble the ball up and run your offense through Blake. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, Blake Griffin played backup point guard for one game during the playoffs last year. That's how starved that team was. But yeah, I mean, if Lance can be that, that's a very nice start. I think DeAndre needs to make another jump, because I think he's the most important piece for them becoming a top 10 defense. Pierce has to maintain. And I think their best path there is just becoming by far the best offense in the league. Just kind of going, you know, Nash era Suns on everybody, but better defensively.
Yeah, that's I think that's right. And, you know, I mean, if DeAndre could like actually become the third best defensive player in the league, which I think he has the physical talent to do, then, you know, maybe they start getting into that area that you're talking about. And if they can suddenly have a really good bench instead of one of the worst in the league as well, that's another way. All right, how about worst case? Not like other than worst realistic case. You know, obviously we're not talking about like Chris Paul or Blake Griffin missing the entire season or something like that. Like, that's not really fun to talk about.
Right. No, no, I'm a Clippers fan. That is not fun to talk about, and that is not something I'm putting in my mind right now. So I'm actually kind of pissed at you for saying that right now. But okay, worst case. Lance Stephenson is a wreck on and off the court. The Clippers waive him midseason because they don't have to pay him for next year. There are problems in the locker room, whether they're leaked or not, because of maybe personalities or sharing the ball or anything along those lines.
Well, the good news is nothing ever gets leaked from this team.
This team is the king of leaks. And I think I know why, but I'm not going to say it, because if I'm wrong, then it'll reflect poorly on me, but I do think I know why. And it's the king of leaks. It's amazing. They leak more than any other team in the league. And I would say worst case scenario, barring, you know, crazy injuries or something like that. I mean, they're still a playoff team. They're so talented that, I mean, last year was kind of in some ways a worst case scenario in that everything went terribly and they still won 56 games. I think we've seen that a healthy core of DeAndre, Blake, and Chris Paul is good for 50, 55-plus wins every single year, no matter what. So I think worst case is like 50 wins, first-round exit, and then people start panicking. You know, we'll see with – we haven't even discussed the drama with Doc and Jillian Zucker with the TMZ stuff, but we'll see, you know, Bill Simmons keeps cryptically tweeting about that there's more to come, you know. Who knows? I don't have any information on that, but what if there is? I don't know how that could affect the team. They lasted okay during the Donald Sterling drama, but that kind of stuff can be an unnecessary and frustrating distraction. So, but I still think worst case scenario is like 50 wins, 6 seed, 7 seed, and first round exit.
Yeah, I mean, to me, as I said, I think you could see Paul taking like a major step back, and that is something that could end up a big problem. Pierce could potentially be done, you know, that, and they might not get much out of him. You know, they might end up having to actually start Wes Johnson because he's the best option at the three, which would be terrible. You know, we could get Detroit, Josh Smith, you know, the fourth big, you know, Aldridge or something. Like, they may just not really have like a backup center. I mean, Aldridge is going to have to play, you know, as a fourth big. So he could be terrible. They could give too many minutes to guys like Crawford and Rivers, and they don't really deliver. So, I mean, but I still think even then, you know, this is a 50-win team regardless. But, you know, they could be the fifth seed, maybe the sixth seed if New Orleans or Memphis does a little better than I anticipate, you know, on the low end. So, all right, we've got the bar. It's probably actually a smaller spread than you would have for just about any team, you know, given the talent that they have. You only have about really like a 10-game spread, but give me your predicted finish in the West and number of wins.
I think they're going to win 58, 59 games and finish second in the West. I still think Golden State is going to win the West.
So you think they're going to have a better record than the Thunder, Spurs, and Rockets?
Yes. That's correct.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I would peg them for 56 again. I mean, I think they'll have some nagging injuries. They'll have guys sit out. You know, I think that their bench could end up being a little bit worse than people think. You know, I mean, I think they're still really dependent on Redick shooting. If anything happens to him, that really kind of gums things up quite a bit. So I would go for 56 wins, but, you know, probably a more dangerous playoff team than maybe they even were the last couple of years.
Yeah, I'm not as excited about the Spurs as everybody else is. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're going to be contenders and they'll be great. And, you know, it's the West. There's no outcome of those top five that would surprise me. But I should say there's no order of that top five that would surprise me. But I don't think the Spurs have a lot of flaws. And if Tony Parker is going to play like he has during Eurobasket. I mean, he looks
– or last year's playoffs for that matter.
He looks slow. Like, bigs are switching onto him and easily keep staying in front of him.
Yeah, and that's, like, European bigs, too. Like, you know, he couldn't go by, like, you know, Felipe Reyes.
Yeah.
In that game, which do you have 10 minutes to talk about that game, by the way?
Yeah, for sure. That was an incredible game.
Yeah. I mean, was there anything else you wanted to say about this, this year's Clippers team?
No. I mean, they're gonna, like, you know, no matter what I project, they're going to break my heart, right? Like, you know, that happens every single year and it's going to happen again. Being a Clippers fan and a Jets fan, like I've told my father, allowing me to become a Clippers fan and a Jets fan should be considered a form of child abuse.
If only James Dolan had also attempted to buy the Jets in 1998.
Exactly. Well, you know what's amazing? Like, only a decision that an 8-year-old would make this decision. Oh, I shouldn't be a Knicks fan because of their owner? Okay, how about I be a fan of Donald Sterling's team then? Only a second grader would think that makes sense.
Yeah, too bad that, like, it wasn't a more realistic video game, because then they could have had, like, you know, the digital Donald Sterling sitting on the sidelines, and you could have seen how abhorrent it was. But, oh well. I mean, hey, at least you've gotten, you know, 4 years now of really good teams with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin. I mean, you can't complain too badly about that. So that Spain-France game was awesome. One of those big takeaways for me was that Parker just did not look good. I mean, the other thing that I thought was he used to be so unstoppable in transition. He would just push the ball so hard, especially in those European games. You'd see him get, like, the Euro stop the fast break foul, like, 4 times a game, and that just didn't happen at all. I mean, he doesn't turn on the Jets for that one-man fast break, and, you know, that used to be a great source of points for the Spurs, and I think that's done now for him.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. It was very disconcerting. I'm a big Tony Parker fan. I've always really, really liked watching him play. And part of his incredible abilities was always kind of his ability to get switches and make those shifty moves to get into the paint. Like, what made Tony Parker so good was that he would lead guards in points in the paint all the time, or be in the league leaders in points in the paint among guards every single year. I mean, you'd be looking through points in the paint with and you just see big after big after big Tony Parker, big after big after big. It was amazing. And if he can't get into the paint, like, his game has totally changed.
Yeah, I mean, he started shooting a little bit better on set shot threes last year. And granted, he had to take a lot of shots, that were tough on this French team. You know, I didn't think that they had the best offense. Boris Diaw also did not have a great tournament. I picked them to win the tournament because of their defense, and they couldn't stop Gasol. I mean, Gasol had 40 of their 80 points and really just an unbelievable performance from him. I don't know what happens to him that he's just so unbelievable in European play, but, you know, it works for him.
He was amazing today. I mean, oh man, he was so good. He did it on, like, 21 shots, too. 40 on 21 shots. Like, he was...
Yeah, he did get some help from the refs, I will say that. Like, I've never seen somebody get more off the ball or, like, non-shooting, just pushing fouls. I mean, I think he got, like, 6 of those fouls in the third quarter alone, and then Gobert getting into foul trouble was huge, and then when he had 4 fouls, it was easier. But see, he was still scoring over Gobert, and he was great on the offensive glass, too. He had some huge plays there. So, yeah, I mean, just a fantastic performance, and this weakened Spain team that really didn't have anyone else playing well except for him somehow beat this loaded French team.
Yeah, well, Powell's a legend, Nate. He's going to get those calls. There's a great story. I don't know how fair this story is, but it is a great story that, 100 years ago or something, I think it was Christy Mathewson was on the mound for the Giants, and it might have been a World Series
game. Oh, wait,
game.
Are you about to talk about baseball on my podcast?
We're talking
right
about
now.
Baseball.
If you don't finish this story in 45 seconds, we're just
fine.
Like ending the podcast.
Fine.
No, all right, no, go ahead. I like baseball history a lot more than I like watching, like, actual current baseball, that's for sure.
Well, this is a fun old baseball vignette. So Christy Mathewson threw a pitch, and the batter, was called a strike, and the batter turned around and said something to the ump about how he thought it was a ball, and the umpire said, "Mr. Mathewson will let you know when it's a ball."
I think I remember that, actually.
That's an old-time baseball.
Good. A tidy 23 seconds there, by the way, Katz.
Good
job. We have not exceeded the yearly baseball quotient on the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We still have like another 22 seconds for like your next appearance on the show as well.
Oh, there'll be more during the. It's amazing that it took me an hour to get to the baseball story.
Yeah, the biggest thing though, getting back to that game, France, like, they just had so many mental mistakes down the end. I thought, and Spain did too, but just not quite as many. I mean, they, you know, missed. I mean, this isn't quite a mental mistake, but they missed 6 free throws in overtime. You know, Parker missed 2, but 2 missed all 3 of his tying free throws. I think Diaw missed 1. So they have that to look at as being, you know, something that really killed them. And, you know, just a lot of bad fouls. Like Gobert, although he complained about the calls, he picked up 2 fouls going for the strip. Like when you have a 9-7 standing reach, maybe you shouldn't be trying to go for the strip, which gets called for a foul 50% of the time, whether it's clean or not.
Yeah, and you could argue that Gobert's foul trouble is what cost them the game, really. I mean, Pau was killing them, or was killing Gobert, really. But he was killing everyone. I'm honestly willing to put more of that performance on Pau than I am on anybody defensively. I don't have the box score called up in front of me, but at one point near the end of the game, like very near the end of the game, I saw Gobert was a plus 14, and I think the game was tied at that point. I'm not a huge fan of individual plus minus for singular games, but I do think that was a telling stat from today's game. I mean, he was really, really important for them on the defensive end. And once he – it wasn't so much that once he fouled out, it went away. It was that once he picked up his 4th foul, he just – like most guys when they get into foul trouble, just became more tentative. And, you know, there were times where – defensive signals got crossed up, and you know there was one play where Sergio Rodriguez got a wide open layup in overtime because they you know him and Batum messed up defensively, and like I don't think that stuff happens if Gobert isn't as tentative in those moments.
Yeah, and they screwed up their pick and roll coverage a couple times. Where the big thought that they were icing and the guard let the guy go over the screen or vice versa. And Gobert was, let's see, yeah, he was plus 11 for the game, as it turned out, in his 31 minutes. So, yeah, it definitely, and as soon as he fouled out in overtime, too, it was massive. Like, they were still up at that point, and then Spain scored, like, 8 points in a row. So, yeah, it definitely really hurt them. You know, this is a Spain team that I didn't think had the horses defensively, and that's why that's always this French offense always disappoints, even when their defense is good. And I would have loved to have seen them go with, you know, play a lot more Evan Fournier, go with Batum at the 4. I don't think they did that for a single second of the tournament, and get some spacing around Gobert, run pick and rolls with Gobert and Parker, give Parker a lot more space. I mean, with the 2 bigs, part of the problem with Parker just not being able to get to the rim at all. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't like their offensive philosophy very much, especially with Diaw not having that great of a tournament.
Yeah. I mean, Diaw not playing well really hurts them, because Diaw at the 4 kind of make what you're saying feasible, right? I mean, they kind of tried that with Joffrey Laverne, right? Laverne will play on the outside a little bit, but he's obviously not as effective as Diaw when he's playing well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when he was playing at the 4, he wasn't going to – he's not someone who's going to get out and transition the way someone like Batum could. And he can hit a 3, but you're not like rushing at him to close out or anything. But yeah, I mean, so do you think do you feel better about Pau after this Eurobasket that he's had? Or do you think, we've seen this before from him, and then he hasn't been as good in the NBA. So I don't make much of it, but maybe you feel differently.
I was never out on Pau, honestly. I'm an irrational Pau Gasol supporter. I think he is. I mean, I don't know how much he works with Joakim Noah. That's another type of discussion. But yeah, I feel perfectly comfortable with Pau going into this NBA season. He looked fantastic today. I mean, even he was running well in transition, and it wasn't just like he was posting guys up and you know just had a move or two that was working really well for him. His hook shot was on. he had some incredible up and under moves. His he was shooting well. He was running in transition and really well. He looked like normal Powell. So yeah, I thought he looked great. I feel totally comfortable with Powell going into the regular season. I think Bulls fans should feel the same way.
Yeah, to me, the issues are that he just holds the ball too long on offense. He doesn't get deep enough post position and get as many foul calls in the NBA. He's a great option if you have a mediocre post defender on him. But I think if he has a good post defender on him, he's not really able to score in the NBA. And then defensively, obviously, I think he's just so bad in pick and roll defense and on the defensive boards. Those are the two reasons that I worry about him. And I think, he can be an effective player, but him like starting the All-Star game and being like whatever it was, second team all NBA last year was, a little bit further than really it should have been. All right. Well, before you go, you got anything to plug? What are you working on these days?
Just kind of doing Fox stuff. I've got a feature on Miles Turner, which I'm not sure when it's coming out. I think it should be coming out either next week or the week after that. And then it's just kind of back to the grind once training camp starts in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. All right. I mean, you'd be doing a lot of Nets coverage this year too.
No, that's TBD right now. So as of now, it's just kind of working at Fox and then figuring the rest out once the season starts.
All right. Well, hire this man because he's does some great features and interviews. So yeah, we'll look forward to having you on again. Maybe you do like a deep dive on the Clippers during the season. That's one of the things we'll probably do is like every week do a deep dive on a team. So we'd love to have you back for that, and thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, tell Danny that I missed him.
Well, you can tell him yourself at the Caesars Buffet in Las Vegas next time. Anyway, and where can everyone follow you on Twitter as well?
Oh, yeah, just what am I? Well, what's my handle? Fred Katz, just my name. I forgot my name for a second, but it's it's just Fred Katz, FREDKATZ.
On that note, you can follow me on Twitter as well. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Facebook page where I'm aggregating all of my writing and, of course, these podcasts. That's Nate Duncan NBA as well. If you want to support the podcast, great way to do that is with an iTunes rating or hopefully positive comment. That's even better. That really helps us in the rankings and to get more sponsors. And, of course, show some love to the sponsors as well. SeatGeek, the cap space code will get you a free $20. So that's a great way to help us keep this little project going. Thanks a lot for listening. For Fred Katz, I'm Nate Duncan, and we will talk to you all next time.